Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous am I sober this day. And I know that it is not customary in some parts of the United States, but it's beginning to becoming rare and rare, and I feel rather uncomfortable because I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous, we give our sobriety days. And we have an old saying down in our part of the country, if you've forgotten your last drunk, you haven't had it yet. And if you can't give your sobriety date, you ain't got one. And so only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to, nor have I taken a drink of an alcoholic night since April the 20th, 1967, and for this I am so thankful. And of course, first of all, it's such a pleasure to be here. This is such a live group, and with so much enthusiasm and so many meetings, and God, it's as AA has always been intended to be. And this is absolutely fantastic, to where everybody can meet in one room, and you have a beginner's meeting back behind here, and this is what AA is all about. And so my role, the first section will be, and it was read a while ago and very beautifully, about why we need a conference. But the reason that we need a conference is I'm going to start out first with a subject that Jim B. is very, very in love with, and that is the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to talk about the history of the writing of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the talking about writing a book first started in the living room of Dr. Bob and Annie Smith. And Bill landed in Akron in the summer of 1935. And a little group got caught hold, and Bill helped found the first AA group in the world, although in those days it was not known as Alcoholics Anonymous. But basically the format was the first group in the world, regardless of what you may hear about someone else. And it was with new groups, it was nearly all failure. But now and then, somebody would see the light, and there would be a little progress. Bill went back to New York with a little experience and started a group in New York called the Old Manhattan Group. And by the time 1937 rolled around, AA had spread over into Cleveland, began to move south from New York, but it still was, in those years, more or less flying blind. A flickering candle, indeed, that at any moment could be snuffed out. So on the late fall afternoon in 1937 in Akron, Dr. Bob and Bill were talking together in Dr. Bob's living room, and they began to count sober noses. How many people had stayed dry in Akron and in New York, maybe a few in Cleveland? How many had stayed dry, and for how long? And when all of this was totaled up, sure, it was just a handful, 35 or 40 maybe, but enough time had elapsed on enough really fatal cases of alcoholism so that when they grasped the impact of those small statistics, Bill and Bob saw for the first time that this thing was going to succeed, that God in His mercy and wisdom and confidence had thrown a new light into the dark caves and tunnels where our kind had been and were. And you know, believe it, and still by the million, believe it or not, there's still millions out there that are drinking. They don't know anything about television spots. They don't know anything, and it's our responsibility to find them, not sit around and say, let them come here and get it like I got it. Because I'll tell you what, if we'd have done, many of us would have done that, we wouldn't be sober, we wouldn't be alive today. And Bill and Bob became thrilled, and they began talking and reflecting, that even though there were just a couple of score of sober members, it had taken 3 long years. Sure, there had been a lot of failures, but it had taken 3 long years to sober up only a handful. Now, how could this handful carry its message to all of those who still didn't know? And after all, not all the drunks in the world could come to Akron or New York. And how could they transmit the message to them? By what means? And Bill and Bob thought that maybe they should go to the old-timers. And well, in those days, everybody was an old-timer. A new one would come in and get sober. 2 days later, a new one would come in and get sober. The one 2 days sober would be the new one's sponsor. Then the sponsor would get drunk, and then the new one would be his sponsor, you know. They held hands in those days. And then everybody, you know, old-timers said, yeah, man, then go find a sum of money, somebody else's money. Now, that's every drunk, you know, he can operate better on somebody else's money. And say to them, now take a year off of your job. Well, if you have one, most of them didn't have a job. And go to all parts of the country during this year get groups started. Now, hospitals in those days were not too happy with drunks, you know. They put them in, they'd admit them under stomach trouble. And the old drunk would lay up in that bed, you know, and he'd be up there with the heart patients, and he'd be up there with all the other surgery patients and everything else. He'd lay in the bed, and he'd set fire to beds, cigarettes, you know, and then he'd get down the hall 3 o'clock in the morning in them paper shoes and do that Thorazine shuffle, you know what they do. And he'd say, "Hi, hey, nurse." And it was hard on the heart patients. It was hard on everybody else. Because in those days, you know, and drunks weren't such nice preachers, you know, creatures, you know. So therefore, A is going to have a great chain of hospitals. Sort of like chain drug stores, chain grocery stores, chain department stores. Because the chain business back during those years, right after the Depression, were the only ones that were making a little money. So why not have a chain of drug tanks? And then they could really make the money. So they decided they needed some missionaries, subsidized, of course, by chain of drug tanks. Now, Bill, being a Wall Street promoter, had far more insistent about these two needs than Dr. Bob. After all, it would take a ton of money to finance all this, and after all, with all this brand new light shining in the dark world, they would just squirt it in the eyes of the rich, and then they would kick in the money. Besides, he also reflected that it also had to get some kind of literature. Now, up to this point, not a syllable, not a single word of the program was in writing. It was sort of word of mouth deal with variations according to each man or woman's fancy. In a general way, this was the pitch. Booze has got you down, you got an allergy and an obsession, and you're hopeless. If you are, then you better get honest with yourself. Take stock. You ought to talk this out with someone in confidence, and you ought to make restitution for the harms you did, and you ought to make amends. And you prayed the best you could, according to your belief, if any. Now, that was the sum of the Word of the Mouth program up to that time. And variations of that was already appearing. And so Bill and Bob wondered, how could they unify this thing? Could they get out of their experience certain principles, describe certain methods that had done the job for them? So it became obvious that if this movement was to propagate itself, it had to have literature. So its message could not be garbled, either by the drunks or by the general public. And believe it or not, one of the greatest challenges and problems we have right now within Alcoholics Anonymous, that there are hundreds of thousands of our members right this very second who do not know what Alcoholics Anonymous is not. And they garble the message, and it naturally goes out into the public, and it confuses a lot of people, and that was the purpose of our literature, and that was the purpose of our book. So they needed some missionaries, a chain of drunk tanks, and a book. Even at that early days, both Bill and Dr. Bob began to learn that they were not the government of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bob, perhaps more than Bill, already realized that the conscience of the group, the informed conscience or opinion of the group, in the group's best interest, it could be better than both Dr. Bob's and Bill's, so they thought it better be to consult people. A non-alcoholic by the name of T. Henry Williams and his wife let the Akron bunch meet in their house. So a meeting was called of the Akron group, that is, those who had been sober any length of time. And they managed to scrape up about 18. And Bill and Bob told them that they were within sight of success, that they thought that this deal would go on and on and on, that a new light was shining in the dark world. But how could this light be transmitted without being distorted and garbled? And at this point, the meeting was turned over to Bill, and Bill, being a salesman, a con artist, and a promoter, and he set right to work on the drunk tanks and subsidies for the missionaries. And they touched a little on the book. And the group conscience, which consisted of 18 men, were darn skeptical about it all. Almost with one voice, they shout, "Let's keep it simple. This is going to bring money into this thing. This is going to create a professional class, and we'll all be ruined." Bill countered by admitting that their arguments had merit, but he also reminded them that alcoholics were dying like flies. And how, he said, are we going to carry this message to others? He reminded them that they had to take some kind of chances. He said, we can't keep it so simple that it becomes an anarchy and thus gets complicated. We can't keep it so simple that it will not propagate itself. and that we have to have a lot of money to do this. And after Bill had exerted his conning to his utmost, they finally got a vote in that meeting, and a close vote at that, by just a majority of 2 or 3. And the meeting then turned to Bill and said with some reluctance, "Well, if we need a lot of money, you better go back to New York where there's plenty of it, and you raise it." And that was just exactly what Bill wanted to hear. Just what he'd been waiting for. So he scrambled back to the Big Apple, and he began to approach some people with money and to describe this tremendous thing that had happened. But it did not seem so tremendous to the people with money at all. "Why," they said, "35 or 40 drunks sobered up. They've been sobered up before, and now you know them. Besides, Mr. Wilson," they told him, "don't you think that it's kind of sweeping up the crumbs? Wouldn't something for the Red Cross be better?" With all of Bill's cunning, he got one heck of a freeze from the gentleman with money. Things were rough in New York. They were starving to death on Clinton Street. Drunks were eating the Wilsons out of house and home, for in those days they never charged anybody for anything. And Bill's wife, Lois, was earning the only money that was coming in. And Bill was being a missionary. And the drunks were eating all the meals. This couldn't go on. Bill kept plugging away to get them drunk tanks. And he said, "We've got to have them missionaries, and we've got to have a book." One morning, Bill called on his brother-in-law, a physician, Dr. Leonard Strong. And Bill started to bellyache about how those rich guys wouldn't give him any money. This great and glorious enterprise, it was well on its way. It seems, however, that Dr. Strong knew a man who was tied up with the Rockefeller family and their charities, because he had met this gal in high school, and she had this uncle. And he asked Bill if he wanted to, well, maybe they could call up the Rockefeller offices and see if there was such a man. And if there is he still alive? And if he's still alive, would he see them? Well, Bill hadn't tried the Rockefeller offices yet, so they agreed to give him a ring. Oh, on what slender threads our destinies sometimes hang. Remember, Bill's brother-in-law said, "I went with this gal, and she had an uncle." And so the call was made. A voice came on the wire, the voice of Mr. Willard Richardson, a non-alcoholic and one of the loveliest gentlemen that Bill and Alcoholics Anonymous would ever know. And the moment he recognized Bill's brother-in-law, he said, "Why, Leonard, where have you been all these years?" And after a few exchanges, Dr. Strong explained to Mr. Richardson that he had a brother-in-law who was having success in sobering up drunks, and could the two of them come over and see him? "Sure," said Mr. Richardson, "come right over." So they went over to Rockefeller Plaza, and right into Mr. John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s personal office, and asked to see Mr. Richardson. And after meeting Mr. Richardson, Bill sat down and told him about their exciting discovery, this terrific cure for alcoholism that had just hit the world, how it works, and what they had done. And this was the first receptive man with money or access to money, and above all, perhaps Mr. John D. Rockefeller's best personal friend, and he was also his spiritual advisor. And so Mr. Richardson said, "Why, yes, he was much interested." Then he asked Bill to have lunch with him, and for a rising promoter, Bill thought things were looking up. During lunch, they would go over the deal again. And after lunch, he asked Bill if he would like to have a larger meeting with some of his friends. He said, "There's Mr. Frank Amos in the advertising business, and he was on the committee that recommended John D. Jr. to drop the prohibition business. And then there was Mr. Leroy Chipman. He looked after all of the Rockefeller's real estate. And then there was Mr. Scott, chairman of the board of the Riverside Church, which is commonly known as the Rockefeller Church, and a number of people like that, and that he believed would like to hear this story." And so on a winter's night, a meeting was held in late December of 1937. Called in post haste for the meeting, a couple of drunks and Dr. Bob from Akron. Bill came in with a New York bunch, 4 or 5. The meeting was held in Mr. John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s personal boardroom, and Bill really got excited when he was told that he was sitting in the chair just vacated by Mr. Rockefeller, and Bill could just feel that money coming right up into his hip pocket, you know. Dr. Silkworth was also there, and he testified what he had seen happen And each drunk, thinking of nothing better to say, each told their story of drinking and their recovery. And still today in Alcoholics Anonymous, the best talk that any of us can ever make is to tell what it used to be like and what happened and how it is today. And that is where the format started. That was a powerful message that they brought to these non-alcoholics. And after seeing that these good new friends were interested, Bill started putting on the big touch by bringing up the subject of drunk tanks, subsidized missionaries, and the question of a book or literature. Well, God moves in mysterious and wonderful ways to perform, but it certainly didn't look like a wonder to Mr. Bill when Mr. Scott, head of a large engineering firm, chairman of the Riverside Church, looked at this bunch of drunks and said, "But gentlemen, up to this point, this has been the work of goodwill only. No buildings, no properties, no paid people, just one carrying the good news to the next. Is that not true?" And here is where he dropped his bombshell. And may it not be that that is where the great power of your society lies, and how true that has turned out to be. The great power of one drunk talking to another. Then Mr. Scott said, "But if we subsidize this, might it not alter its entire character? We all want to do what we can. We are gathered here for that. But would it be wise?" Then all the drunks gave Mr. Scott the rush and said, "Why, there are only 40 of us, and it's taken 3 long years to sober up 40. Why, millions will rot before this thing gets off the ground, and unless we have money, and a lot of money." So one of the businessmen volunteered to investigate them very carefully. And since poor old Dr. Bob was harder up at that time than Bill, and since the first group was in a typical community situation in Akron, the drunks directed their attention out there. And Frank Amos, who later became a trustee of the old Alcoholic Foundation, at his own expense, went out to Akron, made all the inquiries about Dr. Bob. All the reports were good, except that Dr. Bob was a drunk who had recently gotten over it. He visited the little meeting out there. He went to the Smith's house, and he came back with what he thought was a very modest project. And he recommended that they could recommend a token amount of money at first. Now, for those people, it was a token amount of money, $50,000, that would clear off the mortgage on Dr. Smith's home, would get the drunks in Akron a little rehabilitation place, put Dr. Bob in charge, subsidize a few of those people, start a chain of hospitals and a few missionaries, and then get busy on the book. However, Mr. Richardson took that report into Mr. John D. Jr., who read the report and told Mr. Richardson, "Somehow, I am strangely stirred by all this. This interests me immensely." And then he dropped his bombshell. "But isn't money going to spoil this thing? I'm terribly afraid that it would, and yet I am so strangely stirred by it all." The next turning point in our destiny came when that man, whose business was giving away money, said to Willard Richardson, "No, I will not be the one to spoil this thing with money. You say these men who are heading it are strapped for cash? I'll put $5,000 in the Riverside Church treasury. You folks can form yourself a committee. Draw on it as you like, but please do not ask me for any more. But I want to hear what's going on." Well, the $50,000 had shrunk to $5,000. Then the drunks paid the mortgage on Dr. Bob's house, about $3,000. And that left $2,000, and Bill and Dr. Bob started eating away at that. Well, what are you going to do now? You know, none of them ever thought about going to work, did you? Well, they had meetings, and those fellas who stuck with their newfound friends, Amos, Richardson, Scott, Chipman, and those fellas who stuck with the drunks from then on. And in spite of Mr. Rockefeller's advice, the drunks again convinced their new friends that this thing needed a lot of money. So one of them proposed that they form a foundation, something like the Rockefeller Foundation. And one of them got a free lawyer from Elihu Root's office who was interested in the thing, and the drunks asked him to draw up an agreement or of trust, a charter, for something to be called the Alcoholic Foundation. Now, why they picked that name, even Bill didn't know. They didn't know if the foundation was drunk or there was drunks in the foundation, you know. And the lawyer, however, was very much confused, because in the meeting, with the foundation was formed, the drunks made it very clear that the drunks did not wish to be in a majority. They felt that there should be non-alcoholics on the board, and they ought to be in a majority of one. Now, the drunks are no fools. You know why they wanted more non-alcoholics on that board than alcoholics? Real simple. In case all the alcoholics got drunk, they could still have a quorum for a board meeting. And they're thinking about maybe an alcoholic being chairman of the board of General Service Board of Alcoholics now. Stop and think. Sure, said the lawyer, but what is the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic? Well, there's always a smart drunk around, you know. And he said, well, that's a cinch. A non-alcoholic is a guy who can drink, and an alcoholic is a guy who can't drink. But if you'd like to see how it is written legally, all you have to do is open up the service manual, read the bylaws of the General Service Board, where it talks about a Class A trustee, those who are not afflicted with the illness of alcoholism, and a Class B trustee, alcoholics who are. And that's how they say it legally, or who cannot safely partake themselves with alcohol. Well, and so at length, they had a foundation, they had a board, which then consisted of about seven, consisting of four of their new friends and some of the drunks. Dr. Bob went on the board, but Bill sort of called his day off, thinking it would be better off later on than maybe not. But Bill left to manipulate. Bill left to be the kind of guy at the scene. He'd get things out and then see which way they would go. So with this new foundation farm, with the idea of needing a lot of money, the drunks started again to solicit money, again from the very rich. Now, they had a list of them and credentials and letters from friends of Mr. John D. Jr., and they said, how could we miss? They asked themselves, the foundation had been formed in the spring of 1938, and all summer long, they solicited the rich. Well, the rich were either in Florida, Africa, Alaska, Hawaii, someplace else, and they preferred the Red Cross, the Salvation Army, their pet projects, and some thought that the drunks were disgusting, and they didn't get one darn cent in the whole summer of 1938. Thank God they didn't. In the meantime, they began to hold trustee meetings, and they were commiseration meetings on getting no dope. But with the mortgage and Bill and Dr. Bob, what was left of it eaten away, the $5,000 was gone, and they're all busted again. Dr. Smith had trouble getting his practice back because patients were a little leery about being carved up by an alcoholic surgeon, even if he'd been 3 years sober. And stop and think about it. Our two co-founders, Bill, a busted New York Wall Street stockbroker, and Dr. Bob, a rear-end surgeon. Now, that's a combination, isn't it? Dr. Bob didn't realize he'd been working on drunks' brains all these years. He couldn't figure that out. No. And things were tough all around. Well, what they do now? So on one summer day in August 1938, Bill produced at a foundation meeting a couple of chapters of the proposed book in rough and in mimeograph. As a matter of fact, they had been using these chapters of the proposed book along with some recommendations from some physicians down at Johns Hopkins Medical Center to try to put the bite on the rich. Then Frank Amos said, I know the religious editor down there at Harper's. Why don't you take these two book chapters down to Harper's to Mr. Gene Axman? Your story and the introduction of the book, and see what he thinks about it. Well, and to Bill's surprise, Mr. Axman, who had become a great friend of ours, looked at the chapter and asked Bill if he could write a whole book. Bill said, why, shoot, won't take but just a few days, you know. Sure, Mr. Axman. Then the Mr. Axman took the two chapters in Mr. Canfield's office, and another meeting was held, and the result was that Harper's intimated that they would pay Bill as the budding author $1,500 in advance royalties, bringing in enough money for Bill to finish the book. At first, Bill felt very elated about the deal, but then after a while, he didn't feel so good because Bill began to reason, and so did the other boys in the group. Well, if this guy Wilson eats up the $1,500 while he's doing the book, then after the book gets out, it's going to take a long time to catch up, and if this thing gets all the publicity, what are we going to do about inquiries? And after all, what's a lousy 10% royalty anyway? Then they thought, too, that though Harper's was a fine publisher, if and when done, could prove to be the main textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous, why would we want our main means of propagation in the hands of somebody else or strangers? Shouldn't we control it? Well, at this point, the book project really began to take off. Well, he said what they ought to do is form a book company, a publishing company, incorporation. We'll call it Works Publishing Company, this being the first of great many works. Then they could sell stock certificates to all the drunks to get some money coming in to support Bill, the author, and the guy who was collecting the money, and Ruthie Hawk, the gal, the secretary, was helping put the book together. So they took the idea to the next trustees meeting, and the trustees all shook their heads and said, no. Well, they had an alcoholic rebellion, and they told them non-alcoholic friends of theirs, well, after all, you didn't produce any money, and we think we'll try this on separate from the foundation. So Bill had a drunk helping him by the name of Frank Parkhurst, one super promoter. And Hank said to Bill, come on, Bill, this is simple. Come on with us. So they walked into a stationery store, and he bought a pad of blank stock certificates. They wrote across the top of them, Works Publishing Company, par value $25. And, of course, it wasn't incorporated for a long while. And then they took a pad of these fake stock certificates. Of course, they didn't bother, as I said, to incorporate it. And that didn't happen for several years until the next day meeting. Well, you shouldn't mix spirituality with money. And they say to the drunks, look here, this thing is going to be a cinch. Parkhurst will take a third of this thing for his services rendered. I, Bill, the author, will take a third for my services rendered, and you drunks can have a third of these stock certificates, par $25, if you'll just start paying up on your stock. If you'd only want one share, $5 a month for 5 months. And all the drunks gave Bill and Hank that stare. And they gave him and said that cold look, and they said, what the heck? You mean to say that you're asking us to buy a stock in a book that hadn't even been written yet? Well, sure, they said. If Harper's will put money in this thing, why shouldn't you? And they say it's going to be a good book, but the drunk says, no deal. So Hank and Bill started a new pitch at the drunks, and they told them that they'd been looking at the printing costs of a book. He said, we've got a book here that's going to have, maybe 450 pages, you know. It ought to sell for about $3.50. And they found out in those days that they could, on inquiry from printers, that a $3.50 book that was sold for that kind of money could be printed for 35 cents, making 1,000% profit. Of course, they didn't mention the other expenses. So just think, boys, when these books move out in carload lots, we're printing them for 35 cents, we're going to sell them for $3.50 by direct mail, and how could they lose? And the drunk said, no. So Hank and Bill figured that they had to have a better argument than that. How are we going to convince the drunks that these books will move out in carload lots, millions of dollars? So they get the idea to go up to Reader's Digest. So they got an appointment with Mr. Payne. Now, that you just don't make an appointment with Mr. Payne in those days. It just so happens that Dr. Silkworth, I'm going to throw this in, that Dr. Silkworth was renting a house from Mr. Wallace. And Mr. Wallace was the owner of Reader's Digest. And every time he sent his rent check in, he began to send in to Mr. Walters, who was a treasurer, little snatches of Bill's story, this book that was coming on. And it was through that they got that appointment to Mr. Payne. And so, Mr. Payne was the managing editor. And Bill and Hank excitingly told him the exciting story of this budding society. They dwelled on the friendship of Mr. Rockefeller, and then they just brought names out of the hat, who they thought Rockefeller knew, like Harry Emerson Fosdick. And the society was about to publish a textbook. Would this be not a matter of tremendous interest to the Reader's Digest? Of course, the drunks were thinking, with Reader's Digest circulation of in those days about 12 million readers, if they could only get a free ad, that would really move the book. Now, Mr. Payne liked the idea and asked Bill when the projected book would be finished. Then he would take it up with the editorial board, and when the thing is right, he said, you get the book all ready to shoot, come on up, and we'll put a special feature writer on this thing. Well, this was all that Bill and Hank needed to hear. And so they went back to New York to the drunks and said, well, look here, boys, there are positively millions of dollars in this thing for us. How can we mess? And after all, we need only $4,000 or $5,000, so they began to sell shares in Works Publishing, not yet incorporated, $5 a month to poor people. One guy bought 10 shares, then he sold a few shares to non-alcoholics, and Hank, who was very important in this deal, because he went out and kept collecting the money. So Bill and Ruthie Hawk, the secretary, could work on the books. And Bill's wife, Lois, would have some groceries, although she was still working in the department store. Well, so the preparation started, and more chapters were written. And then they went into AA meetings in New York with these chapters in the rough. And the drunks start chewing the chapters apart. And Bill suddenly found himself in a whirlpool of argument. And Bill just became an umpire. And he said, look, boys, over here, you've got the holy rollers who say we need all of that good old-fashioned stuff in the book. Over here, you say you have to have a psychological book, and that never cured anybody. And they didn't do too much with the drunks and the missions, so I guess I'll just have to be the umpire. You just have to leave it to me. I'll scribble out some things here. Let's get the comments in. So they fought, bled, and died through one chapter after another. Then they sent them out to Akron for their comments and approval. And once again, terrific hassles developed on what should go in the book. Meanwhile, drunks were set writing their stories. And then came that night when they got to chapter 5. Because here is a point in the book where the book had to say what this thing is all about and how this deal worked. As I said, it was originally a 6-step program. And one night, Bill was laying in the bed trying to think what this chapter 5 would be all about. Then the idea came to Bill that we need a definite statement, concrete principles, that these drunks could not wiggle out. There can't be any wiggling out of this deal at all. And the 6-step program had 2 big gaps in it. Moreover, if and when this book goes out to distant readers, they would have an absolute explicit program by which to go by. And while Bill was thinking these things over, and while he was mad as heck at those drunks because the money was coming in slow, the doorbell rang. Bill went to the door. And there stood a man, a member of the group, and he brought a brand new drunk. And Bill asked him, and they asked Bill what he was doing. He told him they had a terrific argument. And Bill run them off. And Bill went to bed with a pad of paper and a pencil lead, and he said to himself, I have to break this thing up into small pieces. And he just started writing, trying to bust it up in little pieces. And when he got the pieces set down, he put numbers on them. And he was agreeably surprised when it came out at 12. And here is where he filled the gaps, the 2 big gaps in the 6-step program. And he noticed that instead of leaving God idea until the last, he put it up front, and he put in 2 of the most finest steps, the glue and the anchor of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, steps 6 and 7. Well, he looked at it, but he didn't pay too much attention. He thought it looked pretty good. By the time the next meeting came around, Bill had gone around beyond the steps, trying to amplify them in the rest of that chapter. And then when he took the steps and that chapter into the meeting, all heck broke loose. What do you mean, changing up our program? What about this? What about this? This thing is overloaded with God. We do not like this. You got these drunks on their knees. Stand them up. A lot of these drunks are scared of being God bit. Let's take God out of it entirely. And such were the arguments they had. But out of this terrific hassle about the 12 steps, there did come a 10th strike. That argument caused the introduction of the phrase in the book, which has been a lifesaver for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of alcoholics and those to come, which by Bill's own words, something not of his own doing, because Bill was still on the pious side there, and you'll still suffer from his hot flesh. But those words, the idea of God as you understand him, came out of that perfectly ferocious argument. And that was put in the steps in the book. Little by little, the book ran down. Little by little, the drunks put in the money. The office was kept open over Newark. The money ran low at times. And little Ruthie Hawk, the secretary, worked for no pay, but she was given plenty of stock. All they did, if she needed some money, was tear off some more of those stocks, stock from the bank pad and fill it out and said, here's another week's pay, you know. In January 1939, when somebody said, why don't we test this thing out with a pre-publication copy, a monolithic or mimeograph copy of this text, with a few of their stories? Try it out on the doctor, the preacher, the Catholic Committee on Publications, psychiatrists, policemen, fishwives, housewives, drunks everywhere. just to see if they have anything that goes against the grain any place, anywhere, and also see if we can get some better ideas. At considerable expense, a pre-publication copy was made. Comments came back, many very helpful, and it went to the Catholic Committee of Publication. And in New York, at that time, they only had one member who had come from a Catholic home and to take it there, and he had just gotten out of the nut house and had nothing to do with preparing the book. And to their great surprise, the book was well received and they were impressed. Somehow the stories got in. Somehow the galleys were gotten together. Then they got up to the printing contract. But the drunks weren't paying up. So Bill went to see Colonel Charlie Towns, the colonel who believed mightily in the drunks, so they put the slug on him for $2,500. But he said, "I'm going to let you have the $25, but I don't want any of that phony stock that you got. Just a promissory note on a book not yet written." The $2,500 was rooted around the Alcoholic Foundation so it could be tax exempt. And in these 6 months with the office and supporting three people, they had blown and spent $6,000, and the till was getting mighty low again. So they still had to get it printed. So they went up to Cornwall Press, the largest printer in the world at that time, and asked about printing. And they said they would be glad to do it, and then ask how many books they wanted. Well, they gave them the same old pitch about having a small membership, but the Reader's Digest was going to write an article about the book, and it was hard to estimate how they need. But they assured the printer that they would move and sell in carload lots. The Mr. Printer was none other than Mr. Blackwell, who became later one of our greatest friends. Mr. Blackwell said, "Well, boys, how much of a down payment are you going to make? How many books would you like?" So they told him, "Well, let's print 5,000 to start with." And then Mr. Blackwell said, "Well, what are you going to use for money?" And he was told, "Well, not very much. Maybe a few hundred dollars on account. But remember, we're traveling in good company. We're traveling Mr. Rockefeller and all of his important friends." And so Mr. Blackwell started printing the 5,000 books at 10 cents down per book. Then all of a sudden, they thought of the Reader's Digest. So they went back to the Reader's Digest. They walk in on Mr. Payne, and they say, "We're ready to shoot." And Mr. Payne said, "Shoot what?" And then he said, "Yes, I remember you, Mr. Parkhurst and Mr. Wilson, when you were here last fall. I told you that the Reader's Digest would be interested in this new work and this new book. But right after you were here, I consulted with our editorial board, and much to my great surprise, they did not like the idea at all. They said that the fellowship and the recovery program and your book was too controversial, and I just simply forgot to tell you." Well, they had the drunks. Bill and Hank had the drunks hooked with $4,000 or $5,000 in it. They had Charlie Towns hooked for $2,500, and on the cuff was the printer, and maybe only $500 left in the bank. Morgan Ryan, who had taken the book over to the Catholic publicity, had at one time been a tremendous advertising man. And he said, "Look, I know Gabriel Heater. And Gabriel Heater is putting on these 3-minute radio programs on the radio, and I'll get an interview with Gabriel Heater." So their spirits rose again. And then all of a sudden, they had a big chill, supposing that Irishman got drunk before Heater interviewed him. Meanwhile, Heater agreed to interview Morgan, and the drunks got still more scared, so they rented a room in the downtown athletic club, and they put Morgan in there with a day and night guard for 10 days. Meanwhile, their spirits were rising. The drunks could see these books just flooding the market and flooding the country. And then they said, "Now, what we need to do to follow up on this Heater thing to be heard all over the country, and I think where the big market was for this book are the physicians and doctors, and I suggest we take the last $500 we got in the bank and send out a postal card shower going to every physician east of the Mississippi River. And on the postal card, we will say, 'Hear all about Alcoholics Anonymous on Gabriel Heater's program. Send $3.50 for the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, Sure Cure for Alcoholism.'" Well, this was done. They managed to keep Morgan sober. All the drunks had their ears glued to the radio. But you see, the problem was about the book market. The A market had already been saturated because they had 49 stockholders, and they all got a book for nothing. So they didn't have any more members of the A to sell a book for. They were all getting them for free. And the market had been exhausted. But they just envisioned their doctors and their patients buying these books by carload lots. Morgan is interviewed.
Peter pulls out all the stops, and the drunks couldn't wait to get down to the old post office box, 658 Church Street Annex. The address is printed in the back of the first printing of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, big old red. And they hung to it for about 3 days. And then Hank, Ruthie, and Bill went over to the post office, and they looked in box 658. Now, it wasn't the kind that you take a key and open at the front. You had to, it's just an isinglass, and you go around and ask the clerk, because they didn't have that kind of money for that kind of box. And it wasn't a lock box, just looked at glass. And they could see in there a few of these postal cards. And Bill had a terrific thinking spell. But Hank, the promoter, said, Bill, they can't put all those orders in that little bitty box. Why, they got mail bags full back there. And so they go to see the clerk and ask him for their mail, and he brings out 12 lousy postcards, 10 of them completely illegible, written by doctors who were drunk as monkeys, and they had exactly 2 orders for the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were absolutely and utterly and totally broke. The sheriff then moved in on the office. Poor Mr. Blackwell wondered what to do for money and felt like taking the book over. And at that very opportune moment, the house in which the Wilsons were living in was foreclosed, and the Wilsons and their furniture were set out on the street, and the drunk started screaming, where, what about my $500? And that's what you call a bad day. And that was the state of the book Alcoholics Anonymous in the summer of 1939. They began to shop around from one magazine to another. Nobody bit. It looked like the whole thing was going down the drain. However, one of the boys in New York who was a little prosperous at the time in the clothing business by the name of Bert Taylor Saylor. Bill went to see him and told him that there was a promise of an article in the Liberty magazine, but it wouldn't come out until, he said, next September, to be called Alcoholics and God. Written by Morris Markley, to be printed, who was at that time Fulton Ausler, the religious editor of that magazine. And he said, we need $1,000 to get us through the summer. Bert said, well, I don't have the money, but I have a friend down in Baltimore, Mr. Cocker. He's connected with the wet and dry business. And Bill said, now, wait a minute about this wet and dry business. Bert said, heck, Bill, you're not going to be fussy where you're going to get this money. We're all broke. He's a customer of mine. I sell him pants. And let me call him. So Bert gets on the phone, and he gets Mr. Cochran, and he tells him, you know, Mr. Cochran, from time to time, I had mentioned to you this alcoholic fellowship from which I belong to. Mr. Cochran, our fellowship has just come out with this magnificent new textbook, Sure Cure for Alcoholism, and it's something that we believe that every public library in the country should have, and the retail price of the book is $3.50, but if you will buy a couple of thousand and put them in large public libraries, of course, we would sell for that purpose at a considerable discount to you. Mr. Cochran didn't buy that. So then Bert told him there's going to be some publicity about this book that'll come out next fall. But in the meantime, he said, we desperately need $1,000 to tide us over the summer. Would you loan the Works Publishing Company $1,000? Well, Mr. Cochran said, well, what does this Works Publishing Company's balance sheet look like? And when he was told, he said, no, thank you. Then Burke then asked, would you loan the money to me on the credit of my business? Why, sure, said Mr. Cochran. Just send your personal note down and sign it. So Burke hocked the business. A year or two later, Burke's business went broke. And that's the way it was. And that saved the book Alcoholics Anonymous. That lasted until the Liberty article came in. 800 inquiries came in as a result of that. They moved a few books, barely squeaked through the year 1939. But all this time, nothing was heard from John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Meanwhile, foundation meeting after foundation meeting, too bad you're having such a tough time, but we're not going to give you any money. When all of a sudden, about February 1940, Mr. Rockefeller, whom nothing had been heard from since 1937, had been watching all this time with immense interest. Moreover, Mr. Rockefeller would like to give the fellowship a dinner to which he would invite his best friends to see the beginning of this new and promising start. And then Mr. Richardson produced the invitation list. And here was the president of the Chase Bank, Wendell Willkie, John Foster Dulles, the president, Walter Chrysler, Mr. Peterson from the Ford Company, the president of General Motors, the president of every large and chairman of the boards of every large insurance company, banks, university presidents, religious leaders, and with all kinds of very prominent folks. They were all extremely, extremely rich. And a quick look at that list, and Bill figured, by God, that they're worth a couple of $1 billion or more. Man, this is going to be easy, you know. The dinner came, and they got Harry Emerson Fosdick to review the A book. He gave a wonderful plug. Foster Kennedy came and spoke on the medical attitude as he had seen a very hopeless gal, Marty M., recover, one of his patients. Bill got up and talked about the life among the anonymi, and the bankers, 75 strong, sat at the table, interspersed with the alcoholics. Well, the bankers had come as a sort of command performance, and they were a little suspicious. Perhaps this is another one of John D. Jr.'s prohibition deals. But, however, they had drunks interspersed among them, and they warmed up under the influence of the alcoholic. Morgan Ryan was asked at this table by a very distinguished banker, "Why, Mr. Ryan, we presume that you're in the banking business." "No," Morgan said, "not at all. I'm just out of the Greystone Insane Asylum." But unfortunately, Mr. Rockefeller couldn't get to the dinner. He was quite ill. So he sent his son, a wonderful man, Nelson Rockefeller, in his place instead. And after the show was over with, and the drunks were ready to put on the big touch, Nelson Rockefeller got up and, speaking for his father, said, "My father sends word that he is so sorry that he cannot be here tonight, but so glad that so many of his friends are present who can see the beginning of this great and wonderful thing." Something Nelson Rockefeller said that has affected his father's life almost more than anything else in the world. A stupendous plug, that was. Then said Nelson, "But fortunately, gentlemen, this is a work that proceeds on goodwill. It requires no money." Whereupon the $2 billion got up and walked out the meeting. Again, the hand of Providence intervened right after the dinner. John D. Jr. asked that the talks be published in a pamphlet, and he approached the rather defunct Works Publishing Company and said he would like to buy 400 books to send to all of those of his friends who had come to the dinner and all who had not. Seeing that this was for a good purpose, they let him have the books cheap. John D. Jr. bought them cheaper than anyone else since. They sold 400 books to him for $1 apiece. And with the books and pamphlets, he sent a personally written letter, and he personally signed every one of them. And in this letter, he again recited how glad he was that his friends had been able to see the beginning of what he thought would be a tremendous, wonderful thing. How deeply it had affected his life. And then he said, "This fortunately is a work of goodwill. It needs little, if any, money, perhaps a slight amount of temporary help. I'm giving these good people $1,000. Well, when the bankers received Mr. Rockefeller's letter, they all added it up, and he said, "Well, if John D. is giving $1,000, me with only maybe a couple of hundred million, I'm going to send these boys about $10. One who had an alcoholic relative sent in $300. And so all in told, as a result of that dinner, they got together $3,000, which was the first outside contribution to the Alcoholic Foundation. And that money was divided equally between Bill and Dr. Bob so they could keep going. And somehow they solicited that dinner list for 5 years. And at the end of the 5 years, they were able to say to Mr. Rockefeller, "We do not need any more of your money or your friend's money. The book income is helping to support our office. Your groups are contributing to fill in. The royalties from the book are taking care of Dr. Bob and Bill. And we do not need any more outside money." Alcoholics Anonymous is the only recipient of Rockefeller money that has repaid every penny of it. No other fellowship, foundation, or grant that's ever been given by the Rockefeller, none of them have ever repaid it. But AA, because of the principles of self-support, sent every bit of the money back and were at one time even willing to pay interest. Mr. Rockefeller said no. No. Now, maybe you can see that Mr. Rockefeller's decision not to give us money saved the society. He gave of himself. He gave of himself at a time when the whole world, when he was under public ridicule for his views about alcohol. He said to the whole world, "This thing is good." The stories went out on the wires all over the world. People ran into the bookstores to get the new book. an awful lot of inquiries came into our little office on Vesey Street. The book began to pay for an additional secretary, and then comes Jack Alexander with his terrific article in the Saturday Evening Post in March of 1941. And as a result of that came an immense flood of inquiries. 6,000 or 7,000, and Alcoholics Anonymous become a national institution. And such is the story of the preparation of the book Alcoholics Anonymous and of its subsequent effect, whom all of us here right this very second in this meeting have some motion. The proceeds from that book have repeatedly saved the office. But it isn't the money that came out of the book that matters. It is a message that this book carries in it that has transcended the mountains and the seas, and even at this moment, lighting candles in dark caverns and in distant lands. Thank you very, very much. He sent to Mr. Amos, and it says, "Dear Bill, I'm rushing off to you an excerpt from a letter just received from Mr. Thomas H. Uzel, the former editor of Collier's Magazine, writers of several books, contribute to Collier's Saturday Evening Post, etc. And as you know, hardly a year goes past when one of Mr. Uzel's writings do not appear on the bestsellers list. Incidentally, this might be interesting to you. Such books as The Good Earth, If I Had Four Apples, The Outward Room, three Book of the Month club books, the bestsellers for months after publishing, were submitted to him for criticism and final editing and designing. In the publishing and literary world, I know there is no one so well established and liked as Mr. Uzel. I have gone into considerable length in regard to this because the following portion of his letter has made me so enthusiastic. Quote, I spent last evening with the manuscript. I knew, of course, what the document was, but upon reading additional chapters and surveying the job as a whole, I found myself deeply moved, at times full of amazement, almost incredibly. And during most of the reading, I was extremely sympathetic. My feeling at the moment is that you should certainly hold on to the production and distribution of this volume, if you can. Of course, you ought to go far, wide, and handsome, and net those concerned a reasonably net profit. You have here an extremely urgent problem. You have a successful defiance of medicine. You have a religious story. You have a deeply human story. And lastly, you have a whole flock of happy endings. My God, I don't know what else you could want for a good book. And I believe it in most emphatically." That comes from one of the greatest, what it used to be, used to take books and edit them, you know, for their final before they go out to sale and clean them up. And this is what people think about our book when we read it, if we can get our members to do so. Okay, now the next thing we're going to do, what time is it? We got enough time. What time am I supposed to get to this session? Anybody know? Huh? At 2:30? 1:30. Huh? At what time? 1:30? Okay. Well, it really doesn't make any difference because... Huh? Well, it does make a bit of difference to me. You can do whatever you want to do. You know, let me tell you something about drunks. And I know I'm one. You know, our brains is in our rear end and our rear end is in the hip. That's the precise reason we can't sit in the meeting more than an hour, wear our brains up, you know. Well, I'll start on the history of the service of Alcoholics Anonymous. And almost 57 years, we've been watching a great building under construction and constantly being refined. But to us, it is much more than a building. It is a temple. It is a cathedral of the Spirit. Until which well over God knows how many. Today we have 1,000,000 3/4. We really can't tell you how many members have already entered. And therein has found a peace and a freedom that in other days we never could have even dreamed of. And so this afternoon I will talk about the efforts and reasons for the completion in the spiritual sense of our cathedral. Although there is hope that its great floor expands to accommodate the millions yet to come, and its traditional sidewalls contain us all in unity so long as God shall want it. So let's take each other by the hand, and let us go back to the days of our beginning and together enter into the first dim and dark trail, which during our infancy widened out into a path walked at first only by a few, and finally into this broad highway which we now call Alcoholics Anonymous. As we pass along the path, I would like to indicate to you those great hours of realization that have taken us together and those great hours of decision that have so deeply affected the destiny of our society. And that will bring us to where we stand right now together, and then we will try to lift the curtain of the future a little to see what might hold for this beloved fellowship. Now, when we stop and think about it, A has been and still is a realization of discoveries and decisions that we have shared. It started with Bill's realization and decision after being confronted by his old friend, Eddie, to obtain and maintain sobriety. And in turn, Dr. Bob's realization and decision to obtain and maintain sobriety after Bill's visit with him. And in turn, other alcoholics' realization and decision to do the same after being confronted by a handful of alcoholics beginning to and stay sober. So it became apparent that if our fellowship was to propagate itself, as I said before, it needed a book and some literature with some complete principles so that the drunks everywhere, every place could also come to the realization and decision to obtain and maintain their sobriety. And as I said before, against the early advice against our earliest non-alcoholic friends, the drunks went out and did just that. Number one, a decision that has saved this thing from professionalism and great money, great wealth, and great property ownership. A decision that was made by a non-alcoholic, John D. Rockefeller and his friend, that this fellowship should control his book and own his book. And this book, Alcoholics, and all the literature, it's owned by the trustees of the General Service Board and held in trust for us, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the income from our book and our literature is all ours. And some of it, along with our group contribution and individual members' contribution, goes to pay for our services to groups and to individual members. The rest into our reserve fund, excepting for a royalty of those books, the authored by Bill, which was the only money that Bill ever received, and which today goes now, after Lois passed away, until 1998, into a trust, and then it reverts all back to us. And that was the deal that Lois made after Bill died. And in the year 1941, as I said, Jack Alexander published a piece in the Post, which brought thousands of frantic pleas and inquiries to the small office. Right there and then, AA entered into a new phase. With the advent of the article, AA was confronted with an entirely new problem. The problem was, how could the new groups being formed hang together? The individuals could hang together in groups, but could these groups, these crazy drunks, hang together in multiple groups? Groups began to erupt everywhere, even in the mails. And then they all began to write the New York office of the terrific troubles that they were having, those awful problems. There was a boy and girl problem going on in the clubhouses besides staying sober problems. They had organizational problems. They had missionary problems all over again. And they had big money problems all over again. And they had problems of prestige, problems, nothing but problems. And out of that awesome period of adolescence and on its anvil, the AA traditions were hammered out. Those principles of our group relations and relations one with another, one group with another, and our relations with the world outside. Oh, what a wonderful realization and decision. Then they started to commence to make a lot of very marvelous and singular discoveries about ourselves. That this society of ours is destined to be quite unlike that of any human form of society. Here was this society where the welfare of the whole had to be paramount to that of any individual. Sure, it was important for the individual to survive. But if this group or this movement was to survive, there would not be much recovery for anybody, especially for the millions yet to come. Another discovery and realization was made, that this society does not run on self-inspired leadership. Now they begin to talk about a thing called a group conscience. The group conscience, once it was informed, once people had begun to practice the steps in their life, that the conscience of the group could be wiser and in respect to its own survival than that of any individual member or inspired leader, as long as it doesn't interfere with surrounding groups. Years ago, the old Alcoholic Foundation was chartered to research, educate, and so forth for drunks, anything, every place, everywhere, all the time. No more. We cannot endorse other enterprises. Other enterprises cannot use our names and raise money and get publicity out of it, out of the AA name. It took us years to learn that. We know that AA can devote itself to only one purpose, and that is to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers and other alcoholics. From the very beginning, by deep instinct, we knew that this movement could never quarrel about the kind of things that society outside quarrels about. We knew that if we ever quarreled about religion in here, about politics, if we ever permitted this society as a movement to become rich, we would be done in. So now came our non-controversy traditions. And all the time, we found that our usual traditional attitude about public relations was being put right back in reverse. In this country of ours, where we love to have and worship our public heroes, our athletes, our All-Americans, our All-Pros, our Oscar winners, and erect monuments to great people, where our advertising is run on personal sensationalism, we in AA, however, discovered over the years that this is not for us. So we began to say, let us place principles before personality and people. Let us remain anonymous at the public level. And over a period of years, we have discovered that anonymity is not only the protection of our members, of those coming in, and to those who come, it has a deep spiritual significance. It betokens our individual and our group humility, the willingness to put this thing ahead of our own personal selfish desires. And we have also latterly learned that this is the greatest protection against exploitation that this society can ever have. And that is anonymity at the public level. Within this tradition, there is an immense containing power. For we are now confident that in the application of this tradition in our daily AA lives, that we have a power, an incomprehensible power, which binds this movement together, which can and will render us proof against the forces of destruction that render other societies of men and women apart. But we have to live it in order to ensure it. Next, our recovery, the desire and want that this society remain in unity and in the greatest possible effectiveness. Since the very beginning, there has been a principle in operation which sometimes many of us overlook. And it is one of the purposes of me sharing this with you this afternoon, and to remind all of us to place that principle so it stands alongside of our recovery principle and our principle of tradition. For AA is something more, just more than a belief in the 12 principles of recovery. AA is something more than just a belief in the traditions of AA. If anything, Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of action. When that drunk takes a look at our 12 steps, if he or she is to recover, he or she has got to do something about them. If we have a body of traditions and remain in unity and usefulness, each individual and each group and each entity, each district, each area, each region, each country, and AA as a whole has got to do something about these things. And anything which enables AA to act, to function, we call a service. And many of our activities take the form of services. Still today in AA, we hear the cry, let's keep it simple. And I hope it never ceases. Beware of organization, we hear. But since our beginning, we have found that too much simplicity could result in great complications. When meetings got too big for living rooms, AA meetings moved into halls, AA got a little bit more complicated. It wasn't quite so simple. In the living rooms, there weren't any officers. There weren't any money. But suppose that AA had stayed in living rooms since its beginning, then no services would have been provided. Then AA discovered, much to its indignation, that landlords wanted rent for the meeting places. So that brought the subject of money. Somebody had to pass a hat. And after a while, the old-timer would stick the money in his hip pocket and give it to the landlord if and when he thought about it. And as a result, that gave way to a treasurer. And then there had to be something called a secretary, and they'd argue about what color the hair are, what size chest they were, how little the chest they were, you know. And then they had a chairman, and then a steering committee. That just tickled. You ever try to steer a bunch of drunks, you know? In other words, it began the development of a class of service people who did not and will not ever govern AA, because no human or group or humans can govern drunks. But the drunks will and must name people to perform chores so that the group can function. True enough, service jobs, even the volunteer ones, are thankless ones, but they have to get done. Well, when we get a lot of people in a group, we got a lot of groups in an area, what happens? The old original group, the oldest group, cannot be permitted to run everything. So each of the group names a representative to some kind of central officer in a group association. Finally, they hire a small office, put in a phone, hire somebody to communicate with the new and the older groups, and inform prospective members and are non-alcoholic public about it. When there happens, there's sometimes more often than not a heck of a commotion. Great cries of professionalism go up, that whoever is hired becomes a professional. But years ago, in one of our particular experiences in one of the earliest clubhouses founded, volunteers cleaned up the place, painted the place, the gals made curtains, and it became quite clubby. But then after the enthusiasm wore off, the volunteers became quite negligent in keeping the place clean. Drunks started laying around the place, much too drunk, and it was even said that other people were laying around the place. So it became obvious that they have somebody there all the time. So they approached a good old drunk, sober, who had just gotten out of an insane asylum, about coming over to the club and live, to start to look after things. And they would give him a free room, and he was to sweep the floor. He was answering the telephone, fire the furnace in the wintertime for 7 days a week. And some of the drunks got too drunk or too ugly to lead them outside. And then the old drunk said, "Well, ain't you going to pay me anything?" "Oh, no," he was told. "You cannot make money out of Alcoholics Anonymous. It would ruin this thing." And the old drunk looked at them and said, "I believe you guys have a heck of a nerve. What you guys really want is a janitor. Isn't that right? What the heck does that have to do with my 12-step work? What does that have to do with me staying sober? You all come in here and you use the clubhouse. You come in here and you use the meeting room, you know, and can and will and won't get down here and answer the phone. You can and will and won't come down here and keep the place clean. You won't sweep it out. You won't see that the air conditioning, that the system is on, that the coffee is made. And so, in other words, you want me to come in here and be your janitor for nothing, to do what you want and can't or won't do for yourselves, while you go out and make good living. Now, if you want me to come in here to be your janitor, you're going to pay me for being a janitor. That doesn't have anything to do with me doing 12-step work or my staying sober, and for that, you're not paying me nothing. So you'll either pay me as a janitor, or I won't come in." Well, it took AA years to learn that old boy was absolutely right. In other words, here were a bunch of drunks out making good livings, drawing good pay as a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. There they were trying to coerce that old drunk into contributing about $100 a month worth of labor for free for that club, when most of them were not even giving that club or even putting anything in a basket, much less $5 a month, and some nothing. That attitude was taken because of our early fear of professionalism. And then AA also made the unhappy discoverance that drunks individually and generously, but collectively, folks, we are tighter than Dick's hat band. And you know, they actually beat that old drunk down to half price to get him in there. Then areas found that they had to name representatives to get together to form committees to look after its own in these things, representative services, that enables our society to function and to grow, without which it just couldn't simply function and grow. In fact, it could fall in decay and rot. Yes, too much simplicity would make for too much complication. You simply cannot organize a bunch of drunks, Alcoholics Anonymous, that can never have a government. Why? Because drunks simply will not be governed by human authority. If anything characterizes us, is a lifelong history of disobedience to people, to government, to principles, to everything. But now when we get into AA, we become obedient, all right. But we are not become obedient to our fellow AAs. We become obedient to God. We become obedient to a principle. If we have over 1,750,000 drunks a day and only a handful are breaking their anonymity and making fools out of themselves on the public media every day, and our society, which is composed entirely of screwball egomaniacs, and in proportion where only a handful are out making jackasses out of themselves on the public level, this speaks very, very strong for the containing power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, and that is a tremendous amount of obedience. But it's not obedience to a principle. It is an obedience, not obedience to people. It is obedience to a principle and not to government. But we needed to have a committee to do these things. Literature just doesn't get published by itself. Somebody has to look after it. So throughout our history, from our coffee and cake days to now that we've had to construct services, people have to do special jobs in order for us to function. And it is our job to make and to keep these services and jobs respectable. This is our responsibility to get us and others to feel collectively responsible and in turn to see that they continue to function in the manner of our needs. If not, AA will not go on in its present form, and millions yet to come will suffer. Years ago, Bill and Dr. Bob knew that we needed a few services for the benefit of the whole, that this new movement would need a stand of literature. Hence the tremendous effort to produce a big book plus some literature. A committee of friends went along with the drunks were constructed to be called our foundation. It isn't just holding the book. Somebody has to get it printed and distributed. I don't know if you realize this or not, but they're averaging this past year, they averaged almost 100,000 big books a month sold. It is the greatest volume of hardback cover. Now, this includes also the traveling edition, the soft cover. There's not one book that sells more copies of the original, and that's the big, big book, the Holy Bible. We don't know where to go. We certainly don't. Yeah. While in the whole year of 1951, they didn't sell 25,000 books for the whole year. In the early days, you know, these are profits from the book, took care of office expenses. But as I said, after the Jack Alexander article, flooded inquiries, and all these pleas, and so they wrote to groups. What do you want to do with Antrim? You want to send in money to help us answer, to hire some help, or you want to throw these in the trash? And the group came and helped with the answers, the 1,000 inquiries. Refer them to the nearest group. Help them get new groups. Supply them with books and literature. We'll use the groups and individual members. Voluntarily contribute to the office so that the office can be maintained, so then the job be performed. So in 1941, just a rough measuring stick, the movement was asked if the members would contribute $1 per member per year, then the office can answer all of the mail inquiries and be able to provide the needed services at the time. In our fellowship today, if each member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's sober, will send in just $5 a year, all of our literature would be free, with the exception of the books. And then they could be sold at a very nominal price. Just $5 a year. How much do we value our lives? Is it only worth a buck a day? Or a buck a meeting? I don't know about yours. Yeah. So that was the second step in our evolution. Then the foundation had two kinds of money. They had book money, and they had group and individual contribution money. And our money, which we call our money, can only be spent for and on the office. And then right after the post problem, they had other group problems. What about the Red Riding Hood and Wolves, they called them that day? What about this from all over the world? So that now the office became sharers of our experience from the older groups. The office could say to the newer groups that our experience in these matters tell us this and that. And our office began to propagate all of this information, help organize groups at a distance. Not so much here in this country, because groups were becoming so numerous and we're so close together in distance. If one goes to Europe, goes down under, South Africa, Central and South America, up in the Loners and the Limbs and all over the Near East and uppermost Alaska, Iceland, Far East, these groups will tell you what our office has meant to them. It has and still is, in some instances, the only contact with the AA world, as we in our country today are so spoiled and take these things for granted. So the office took on another protection, you know. With this society needing you, some sort of public relations policy, whose problems in this area were beginning to surface. Just an example, an AA caught fire by reading the big book he had received through the mail down in Jacksonville, Florida. And being one of those super promoters, he was soon on the Jacksonville radio with a curious mixture of AA and some kind of off-brand of religion. He got in a few inquiries, so he writes a letter to our office, informs our office that he has a contract with the Gulf Life Insurance Company and that they're going to hire him as a broadcaster and put him on all an American radio hookup of about 100 stations to give his 13 lectures on Alcoholics Anonymous. And along with a letter, he sends in the script. Well, Bill and the little office staff looked at, and they were terrible. And how could an issue arose? Could any AA member appoint himself or herself to do that job, to stand up on a national hookup and represent all of us? And his script smelled a high heaven. Well, what could be done about it? So Bill writes him a very diplomatic letter congratulating him on starting a group in Jacksonville. But the groups around the country would not like what he's about to do, and frankly, some of the material was not AA. Bill even told him that he himself would not take the responsibility that man was going to take. Bill reminded him that he was going to, that he was going to break his anonymity at the public level, and besides, he reminded him that he was only getting paid to do the job, and he said, frankly, your scripts are not straight A, and they are not very good. Why don't you confer with our board of trustees, and maybe we could revamp this thing and get it maybe to where it'll go good. The drunk then wrote Bill back a letter, a very testy letter, in which he said, to heck with you, Mr. Wilson. To heck with you with Alcoholics Anonymous. To heck with you with your office. This is America, and I have the right to free speech. Well, this brought AA straight square up with an issue. Should we have any control about what is being said about it? Could an AA nominate himself to represent us all in a matter of vital as that, one which would affect the lives of thousands of people? Bill then wrote him back a letter telling him that he would be the first to defend his right as an American citizen to the freedom of speech. But he said, if I'm going to defend your right to speak freely, then I have to see to it that hundreds of thousands of AA in this country also be given the freedom to speak their minds freely about how they felt about this broadcast. Of course, Bill reminded him, if you put this thing on, then I will suggest to the drunks that they write letters to your sponsors, the Gulf Life Insurance Company, the Mutual Broadcasting Company, telling them what they think about your lousy program. And Bill reminded him that you are still at liberty to put it on, but look out for this free speech from about 10,000 drunks. And when those 10,000 drunks get to hollering, you'll really hear it. Well, the broadcast didn't come off, but that raised a problem. Was anybody going to be appointed to look after such matters? So years ago, the group were contacted once again and asked if they would entrust the trustees to overlook our public relations. Local public relations, the groups are free to handle that. But when we get into pieces in nationally published magazines, newspapers, or broadcast media, or motion picture material, would you name this board of trustees to look after these things through the office in New York? The groups and the members wrote in and gave the trustees through the office the control of our public relations. Not a legal control, but a tradition has come up today in AA. If somebody is going to do a job like that, come to the experience to be sure that it is regular, that it is correct. Now the board came into control of the book, into control of our propagation tools, in control of our pamphlets that are through, control of our public relations, plus the very vital ones, controlling the clearing of thousands of requests from drunks. Other services were being provided. It became obvious that foreign groups have to have translators of our books and literature. And this matter of public relations is extremely important. So important, I'm going to share another one with you. One of the finest articles ever to be written about Alcoholics Anonymous, and you get a reprint if you want it. And why they ever took it off our racks, I don't know. Appeared in old issue of Fortune magazine. Our office spent hours and hours with the author. The one who wrote that piece was a vice president of Fortune magazine, and incidentally one of us. And being a good member, he came over to the office to get background experience and some ideas about our traditions and all the other facts that appeared in that piece. And some of the Fortune staff came over to confer with the office. That's the reason it was a good piece, because somebody was looking after these things for us. A lot of our services are unknown and unseen. AA has a good public relations policy because we mind our own business and we don't fool around. And years ago, if you AA started to print a newspaper called The Grapevine, the foundation did not have a thing to do with it. So around 1945, having seen the thing make good, the groups were written to see if they wished to make The Grapevine our principal journal of AA. And almost unanimously, groups wrote back and said yes. So when The Grapevine was attached to the foundation. Those services have directly and indirectly accounted for over half of the size of Alcoholics Anonymous and a great deal of unity. So isn't it obvious that these services are not only needed, but should continue? And if these services should break down someday because they're not tended to or because they are not supported, then millions yet to come may suffer. We're here for that drunk out there. That's what it says, to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. No, AA wouldn't break down, but it sure would slow it up. So around 1945, a few realized these services were very remote from the members and that they were still the function of Dr. Bob and Bill. And Dr. Bob, who was dying from terminal cancer, Bill was horrified when he realized that he and Dr. Bob were the principal links between the board of trustees who looked after these things and us members, and that one of these links would soon be out. And after a while, and Bill would be the only link. And then when Bill went out, then what would happen? then the trustees would be the only link. And the first time that that bunch made a mistake, and the first time that bunch had a problem that was too hot to handle, AA would wake up and find ourselves and our business in the hands of strangers. Then we would say, well, why didn't Bob...